Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who are the first victims of global warming? Not surprisingly, the effects of climate change tend to be most profound in regions that divide frozen and more temperate climates. On the Antarctic Peninsula, warming effects are already as much as 6 times greater than in other places, and wildlife is paying an unspeakable price. Writer Meredith Hooper has seen that for herself, and she writes about the havoc wrought on the region's Adélie penguins, which have lived in the cold for tens of thousands of years but could be extinct from that area within 5. Hooper's new book is called The Ferocious Summer, Adélie Penguins and the Warming of Antarctica. Meredith, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
What sort of conditions exist in the Antarctic Peninsula, the land and the sea and the weather in a typical year?
The thing about the Antarctic Peninsula, it's that long sort of crooked finger that pokes up towards South America. And it's a thousand miles long. It looks small on the map because Antarctica itself is so huge. The whole continent is 1/10 of all land surface on this earth, and it's massive. So people think of the peninsula as not being terribly important, but actually it's a big space. But the warming that's happening on it is completely different from what's happening on the whole of the continent. This is one of the puzzles for the scientists. They've tried to work out why it's different. It also looks very different. It's very beautiful, of course, because Antarctica is stunning. It's the place that most tourists who go to Antarctica, they'll see the peninsula because you can drop down from South America with some ease. It's drowned mountains. It's when you come by sea, which is what everybody does. You sail past these extraordinarily abrupt, tough, sharp-edged, snow and ice-covered rock, some visible rock faces. The mountains just rise straight up out of the sea, and they have streamers of ice coming from their peaks. I think I said they're like samurai flags. They're quite extraordinary. And the water in the fields is quite calm, so you have this utter beauty of reflected mountains. You have very, very little land that's free of ice and snow. That's one of the great characteristics of Antarctica. But you've got a little bit more of it in the peninsula because it's a little bit warmer. And scientists joke, and they call it the banana belt, because compared with the rest of Antarctica, it is a bit warmer, and it's got a lot of islands, a lot of fields, it's sort of a drowned landscape, and it's the place where I was working is America's smallest base. It's only got 40 people. It's called Palmer, and it's on the southern side of an island. And that island is about 20 miles by 40 miles. And even that island has mountains 10,000 feet high. And it has ice covering it to a depth of about 2,000 feet. So even an offshore island has that extreme of landscape, sudden mountains and ice and snow cover.
And how surreal to be working in a place where human beings are not native. There are no people who live there naturally.
It's one of the extraordinary and exciting things about Antarctica. There are no and have never been indigenous people. So you have this huge part of Earth's surface where humans just never have been. And so it's one reason why it's a great privilege to go there, but it's also, I think, one of the real reasons why animals have a sort of casualness about humans. They in a sense raise their eyebrows and maybe move over or maybe not. They're not frightened of us, and so there's I call it a sort of Eden. it's what it must have been like before animals learnt to be frightened of us. And so of course this means that you have an extraordinary privilege of being able to be very close to animals, if that's what you're there to be doing. And I went to I went to work with American biologists, so I had the huge, huge good luck to work with them, and therefore, you know, have more access than obviously I would have if I'd been anybody else.
Yeah, we mentioned earlier that they were studying the Adélie penguins. There are also many other species that they're looking at. Lest anyone get the idea in this exotic and beautiful location that the work is glamorous, can you talk to us about the kinds of information that these very hardworking biologists are collecting?
Yes, I would like to talk about the work that the biologists, the seabird ecologists were doing at Palmer, because that's what I was with. I have been to Antarctica with other scientists, and wherever I go, it's tough. The environment is tough. It's not a particularly safe environment. It's, you know, inevitably, and so a great deal of care and caution has to be taken. At Palmer, the penguins live on little islands offshore. So in order to get to work, we have to go out in boats. And they're some very small zodiacs, the birders, the seabird ecologists are sort of called the birders. And they like small, nippy zodiacs, sort of 16-footers with small engines, because they reckon that they can maneuver them more easily. And we had all kinds of rules, like if the swells were over 4 feet, we weren't really meant to go out. We had to wear, proper clothes, so that if we fell in, we wouldn't drown. We had to wear life belts and all that stuff. But the islands themselves in summer are, mainly they've lost their snow, but they're very, very sharp surfaces. It's a kind of shattered rocks, very slippery. And the thing that I found most difficult to get my head around was that the rocks aren't anchored, because there isn't any earth, and there are a few plants. There's some lichens and some tiny, some high grass and a bit of moss. But, you know, wherever else in the world, you find that rocks will have a bedded down in something, but not here.
So you take a step and sort of your legs slide out from under you.
Yes. I mean, the first time I went to Antarctica, I went on the other side, to the sort of big continent side with the Australians, completely different. And they just taught me, you know, don't trust a rock. Don't put your foot on a rock and think it's going to hold you, because why should it? Whereas on the peninsula side, the islands we went to, every extraordinary thing was every island was different. It was quite amazing. There were mini landscapes, but even within that small context, every island had its own personality and its own kind of rock.
You had been to Palmer in 1998 and early 99, is that right?
Yes, indeed. Yep.
And it was a very different place from what you found in 2001 and 2002.
Yes, it was a cliche, classic, lovely summer, which means, of course, I mean, I've got to be careful when talking to Americans, because you know cold. I mean, not in Texas, but up in the north of America, it gets very cold. And we had a lot of Americans working at Palmer who did know their cold and they knew their ice and snow, whereas I'm an Australian, so I just didn't. I'm very ignorant. But the a nice summer day at Palmer, when the penguins pant because they're hot, is round about zero. And when the sun shines, it's utter extravagant beauty. And, you know, there were enough days when the sun shone for the colonies, the penguin colonies, to be absolutely buzzing with noise, and there'd be a kind of fine pink dust that would be floating above them that came from sort of finely ground up guano and little bits of down and fluff off the chicks. And the noise of the birds is wonderful. I mean, terrific range of greeting calls, and when you listen carefully, you hear the chicks cheeping at very high sound. And that summer was straightforward for the seabird ecologists. What they were doing was, I mean, I should really say what makes Palmer so special is that Bill Fraser, who leads the study, had been working there pretty well on and off since 1975. And so there was a database that had been established, of how many adelie penguin pairs came back every season to breed and raise their chicks on shore. And so this is very unusual because there had been a consistent study using the same database year in, year out, studying these penguins, which is what makes them so special, because if you're going to work on climate change, you need a long-term database.
So you have this database going, and this was that you were describing earlier was 98, 99, where you're hearing all this buzzing and there's dust in the air, and it's this wonderful place. So you sort of had an idea when you went back in 2001 of what you were in for, or you thought you did.
No, not at all. I went back in 2001, 2002, because when I'd been there in 98, 99, I started to talk to Bill Fraser about his ideas and why he thought the way he did and where he got his ideas from. And central to that was that the numbers of adelies were in decline. They just, every year, fewer came back. And the great puzzle was why. And Bill hypothesized that it was actually climate change. And when he hypothesized this in the late 80s, this was very unusual. He was geologists make assumptions about climate change, but not biologists. And Bill was working to sort of find whether his hypothesis stood up. And I thought this was so interesting, because here was a sort of mini story of climate change. I like all outsiders, I didn't have a clue really what was going on with our climate change. And I thought if I could come back to Palmer and work with Bill and try and understand the way he was thinking, what he was trying to find out, what was happening to his penguins, I could track their story. They could become a kind of narrative of climate change. So back I came thinking it would be a little bit more of the same with fewer penguins because of, the impact of climate change. What we got, without any warning at all, because, of course, that's the reality of the climate, is totally different conditions. Day after day after day, week after week, month after month, which came sort of crunching in on us and, of course, the animals. And we didn't know why, we didn't know what was happening. And every morning you'd wake up and think, oh, please, can it be different today? can maybe the sun come out, or maybe it can stop snowing or raining, or the gale could stop or whatever. And it didn't. So what retrospectively we knew had happened was completely anomalous weather pattern set in, and it started in spring and it didn't leave till fall. So it was five continuous months of totally anomalous weather, which is why I called the book The Ferocious Summer. And what we then found out, when all the scientists got their data together and thought about what had happened, was that was a sort of, well, some scientists have actually called it the tipping point on the peninsula. It really did trigger a range of changes, and after it, things got even warmer, and the evidence of climate change was even faster. But on Bill's penguins, the adelies at Palmer, it was devastating, absolutely devastating.
We'll hear more about what was set in motion that horrible summer of 2001-2002 in just a moment. My guest is author Meredith Hooper. Her new book is called The Ferocious Summer, Adelie Penguins and the Warming of Antarctica. You can join our conversation by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Meredith Hooper. Her new book is called The Ferocious Summer, A Daily Penguins and the Warming of Antarctica. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Meredith, I want to stop for a minute and ask about the effect of heat on these animals, because people might have a hard time understanding why the chicks, for example, would do so much worse if it were snowing or raining out, as opposed to just being very, very cold.
Absolutely fair point, Chris. One of the things about changing climates is you don't need very much change of temperature to have a real impact. So the little chicks hatch with down on them, and they've got about 53 days to get from something that fits between my thumb and first finger to something that's as long as my forearm to grow 40 times. And during that, they lose their down and they grow their feathers. And the feathers are what help them, what they need to swim. And, you know, what they go from the land into the sea when they're finished. And the point about down is that it's perfect if it's cold, you know, as you know with the down coat. But it doesn't work in the rain. And so when it rained, which it just never had, because what I should have said is that the aberrant weather was warm. It was the warmest summer ever on record in the peninsula. And what was coming was warm north winds from the north, because, of course, we're in the southern hemisphere. And because it was warm air, it was loaded with moisture, and that moisture early in the spring and summer meant heavy wet snow, which was diabolical for the nests because it buried the nests. And then when it melted, the nests were sort of cups of water, and so it drowned the eggs. And then as the summer progressed and this weather still stuck, the warm, moist air, instead of snowing, produced rain. And you know, that just doesn't happen. And there it was, raining like anywhere else in the world. I mean, you could smell rain. It was quite extraordinary. I go outside and I thought, creep, I can smell rain. And you just aren't meant to do things like that. Well, of course, the rain completely wet the down, and these chicks shivered to death. They just couldn't, they shivered with cold. The other thing is that because of all the heavy, unseasonable snow, the parents sort of tried to delay mating, and then that delayed hatching of chicks, and that meant that the chicks were hatched quite late, and they've only got this narrow window of the summer to be fed enough food to get them to have enough blubber on board to try and survive their first winter. And of course, the space just wasn't long enough, and so they were underweight and they were late, and it was really a pathetic sight. You would just see these poor little bedraggled chicks, far too small. And then when it came to weighing them to see what sort of weight they were as young fledglings, they were too light. They were lightweights. And in any case, after all the effort of raising chicks that the parents put into it, only 80% fail in any case their first year. But of the ferocious summer chicks, not many were going to make it because they didn't even start off heavy enough.
Meredith Hooper is my guest. Her book is called The Ferocious Summer, A Daily Penguins and the Warming of Antarctica. Let's go to Benjamin in Dallas. Hi, Benjamin.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I just had a quick question. You know, you're highlighting a very important issue for the world today. What can we do as human beings to really impact the changes that are occurring?
Oh, Benjamin, that is such a huge question. I mean, I can only answer it as an individual like you are. And I think that the most important thing is for us all to get our heads around the fact that it's actually happening. Because a lot of people's response to this sort of story is, well, initially it was, it's not happening. And then if it is happening, well, what can we do about it? And I think the crucial thing is for us all to say, okay, it is happening, but secondly, we've got to do something about it. And a lot of people aren't there yet.
Along with rain, which never happens or never did before this time, there was a rainbow at Palmer.
Yes.
Which, in any other context, it's funny, we've been socialized in the West to think of this as sort of a lucky thing. But it really sort of spells doom for the animals of this climate.
Well, it did to me. I mean, I suddenly realized that the rainbow was a symbol in our sort of cultural stories of a promise that the flood was going to go away. That's what it is in the Bible. And I suddenly thought, actually, what the rainbow is probably is a reminder. It's reminding us that actually it's raining, and it shouldn't be.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Our email address is think@kera.org. So when you went back in 2001 and 2002, you went to that same sort of nesting area where the penguins would congregate, and instead of being this cacophony of chattering and chicks and noise, it was eerily quiet.
It was like, I mean, working with scientists, they were saying to me, Meredith, you are not to anthropomorphize. You are not to pretend that these animals are anything to do with humans. And of course I didn't. But to me, the colonies were like cities in a war zone. Instead of being closely packed, because in a penguin colony, usually each nest is just pecking distance away from the next nest. And so the birds are very loudly and perhaps aggressively protecting their own space. But this time there were great empty gaps between the sparsely occupied nests, and particularly in the smaller colonies. It was really poignant, because as the chicks get a bit older, they have to crash together, because both parents have to go out at once to feed. They had to get enough food for a chick. They have to be left. Therefore, they come together. And there were some colonies I went to where imagine a sort of stony ridge. And every year before, all the chicks would have been clustered together on that ridge. Now, there was just two little clumps of chicks at either end, and they didn't join up. And so there they were, just these two pathetic little groups, and you knew very well that they weren't going to survive. So it was, yes, it was like, to me, it was very hard not to try and think, what's happened? What's happened to this nest? What happened there? Did those penguins ever come back? Because 40% never even came back. Is this nest here one where the eggs were laid and then they drowned? Or did the parents not even try? I kept on wanting to sort of people the empty spaces and try and work out what might have happened. You began to get very, very involved in individuals.
You have a poignant photograph in the book of a father penguin, I guess a male, with a nest and a chick, but no partner.
No, that doesn't necessarily mean that. It might mean that the partners, probably should mean that the partners aren't getting the food.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is that adelies are remarkable. I mean, to me, they're remarkable parents. I don't know whether that's anthropomorphizing, but I don't care.
That's okay. You have permission to do that a little bit.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I'm a parent, and I don't measure anywhere near a penguin. They are amazing. They are dedicated, hardworking, tough, resilient little birds. They really try, and they keep at it if they possibly can. And so they must take it in turns to feed the chicks. And so, you know, one parent goes off, gets as much food as it can, comes back, relieves its poor, tired partner, who's pretty grubby because a certain amount of defecation has happened on it from other penguins, and then it trudges off to the sea to feed and get another load of food, and the one that's come back looks after the chick. And then when the chick's got so big that it needs both parents out hunting for food, they both go out, and they work at it. They really do. They're also, of course, protecting the chicks from predators, and the predators are skua gulls, and the skuas are again tough, and they're predating to feed their own chicks. So they're not doing it like cats for the sake of it. They only take what they need.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Author Meredith Hooper is my guest. Her book is called Ferocious Summer, A Daily Penguins and the Warming of Antarctica. Let's speak next to Mike in Rockwall. Hi, Mike.
Hello, ladies. How are y'all?
Great, thank you.
Well, I have a comment slash question. We all hear how technology is going to save the day, but I'm just wondering if maybe it's not time to seriously start discussing overpopulation of this planet. In my opinion, it's the root cause of a myriad of problems. And I don't believe, of course, in draconian measures, but I think it's time for the nations and governments to bring this topic out into the open, and scientists also to really, really discuss this seriously, because I think it's just too many people scrambling for too few resources and too many people putting pollutants into the atmosphere. And I'm just going to ask your guest if she thinks maybe it's not time to seriously discuss overpopulation.
Meredith, do you think overpopulation is an issue in this particular question?
Well, I think what your caller has put his finger on is a very important difference between the last time there was major climate change on Earth, there's been major climate changes in the past a great deal, but the number of humans on board Earth is now 6.5 billion. And last time there was an ice age, and then the melting of that ice age, there weren't very many humans. So people had somewhere to go. And I think what we're seeing with the penguins is the penguins occupy a very cold, very austere environment. And Adelies are polar species. There are only two polar species of penguins, emperors and Adelies. And what was really going wrong for the Adelies at Palmer is that the polar conditions were disappearing. They were in a sense moving south, and the subpolar warmer maritime conditions were moving down from the north. And so those Adelies at Palmer were losing the environment that they needed to survive in, and where they'd been for 700 years as a species, living perfectly well. They had the food they needed. They had the conditions they needed. Now, the only place that Adelies can go in order to keep surviving in the way they know how is going further south. And in the end, you know, there's a limit to how far south you can go. And the same sort of thing is happening with the species that live on mid-latitude high mountains. As the snows disappear, those species have got to go further and further up the mountain. And you know what happens in the end? There isn't any more mountain to be on. So, very importantly, there's a heck of a lot more humans this time round than there ever has been before. But I don't think that means we can't wrap our heads around what we're going to do. I think that I've got great faith in the ingenuity and intelligence and ability of humans to solve problems, because we have done before. And I think what we've got to do is acknowledge that there's a big, big problem to solve.
Meanwhile, there are some other species of penguins, notably the Gentoo, that are now thriving in a daily country that was once too cold for them.
Yes, indeed. They're getting the conditions they need. And perhaps, again, there's a lesson here that species that have very precise requirements, if they lose those requirements, if they lose those conditions, they're in real trouble. But other species that have a broader brush ability to manage, and the one big thing the Gentoos do is they're not loyal to them to their colonies. The Adelie comes back to where it laid its eggs last year, and the Adelie chicks come back to where they hatched. So this is what, again, makes them very interesting birds to study, because they're a kind of permanent population. They have loyalty, whereas the Gentoo doesn't. The Gentoo says, I think this looks interesting. I'll try this. And so it's much more adaptable. The second thing about the Adelie is that it absolutely has to have sea ice. Sea ice is central to its surviving, and sea ice is in decline off the western coast of the Antarctic Peninsula. And so it's losing its essential platform. It's losing its winter habitat, and it's losing its summer habitat. But the gentoo doesn't need sea ice. So what, one penguin's loss is another penguin's gain.
Can you talk about how social the Adelies are with each other? We don't want to anthropomorphize any more than possible, necessary.
Well, they are. Of course they are. And this is why people absolutely love watching penguins. I mean, they are gripping. They are communities. They appear to be hugely inquisitive, and they come up and look at you, and then they sort of back off a bit and have another look. They obviously work in living communities, you know, so the pairs relate to each other, and you can just, I mean, I could just stand for hours and hours, or sit or stand or whatever, for hours and hours and hours, just watching particular nest sites and watching what happens, and watching how, you know, how the chicks manage. One of the wonderful things to see is not wonderful, one of the great things to see is most, I mean, they lay two eggs, and mostly they get two hatched chicks, but one hatches 3 days ahead of the other, and that chick is bigger. And so when the food comes back with the returning parent, that older chick is darn well going to get it all. And so it literally just sort of shoves and pushes the small one out of the way, a bit like a rugby player, if maybe it's the same with American football, I don't know, but certainly rugby. Just shove. And the little one just keeps going, keeps pushing and bobbing its head up and hoping and being trod on, but still sort of move, shoving back in. And eventually the older chick will have its stomach so full it's like a sort of saggy bag, and the small one gets its turn. And I mean, this is great stuff to watch. And you watch what Bill called the adolescents who come in. They're just starting to be sexually mature, and you watch them starting to practice.
Meredith Hooper is my guest. Her book is called The Ferocious Summer, Adelie Penguins and the Warming of Antarctica. We'll return to our conversation with her in just a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults, offering summer escapes from the everyday. Short courses start in June. Curious? Details at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Meredith Hooper. Her book is called The Ferocious Summer, Adelie Penguins and the Warming of Antarctica. You can send email to think@kera.org or join us by phone at 1-800-933-5372. We should talk about this because everyone understands that there can be anomalous years of weather. Meredith, if you could go through and sort of reestablish for us the difference between weather and climate and what it took for scientists to understand that what happened in 2001 and 2002 was about climate change as opposed to a year of very strange weather.
Chris, that's a, that's a million-dollar question. One of the things that I had to try and understand as a non-scientist, as an outsider to all this, is how was it that scientists could eventually say this is climate change and that what had happened before wasn't? And I talked to a lot of scientists about this in all kinds of subjects, in glaciology and meteorology, as well as the biologists. The crucial thing is to have a long-term data set. You have to have enough information over enough years collected adequately and properly, so that you can go back far enough to say that something isn't just natural variability, because the Antarctic Peninsula really does have varied climate, but you can actually see a trend. And I mean, I think that one of the great lessons I had to learn was that climate change is about measuring. and that climate, to understand climate change, you have to have some sense of what was before it now is or may be. And you have to say, are there changes and are they measurable? And this means that scientists who are working on climate change are sort of extracting information from the physical world, and they're extracting it now, and they have been over as long a period of time as they can. And one reason why there's very good data coming out of Antarctica is that science has been done there now for a long time, because the Antarctic Treaty established Antarctica as a continent for science. And so there are scientific programs that have been going since the 40s and 50s. So the temperature changes because the Antarctic Peninsula is one of the fastest warming places on the planet. And on the western side, where Palmer is, it is probably the fastest warming in winter. The winter temperature on the western side has gone up 6.3 degrees centigrade in the last since the 1950s, which is massive. It's sort of 10 times the global average. And over the whole annual surface temperature has gone up 6 times. But in order to be able to say this, the meteorologists have got figures that go back to the 1940s. So they're very careful about this. They really, really are cautious and careful. And they would say to me things like, well, 20 years, we're getting somewhere. 30 years, beginning to feel comfortable. 40 years now, that's beginning to be a data set we like. And they've got enough temperature records to be able to look at that upward graph. But maybe if I tell you about Larsen B ice shelf, which you might remember having heard about. It broke up in the end of the summer 2002 while I was there, and Larsen B was just over the mountains, only 100 miles to the east, and it just broke up with no indication it was going to happen at all. It collapsed in a matter of weeks. 500 billion tons of ice unhooked from the edge of the continent and just shattered into smithereens and sailed off into the ocean, gone forever. Now, when that ice shelf broke up, next season the American scientists got in there with their research ship and their ability to they could for the first time get at the seabed beneath what had been this 600 feet deep ice shelf. And they'd been able to get at it before. So now, because the ice shelf had gone, they could. And they took cores of the seabed, and they found that there had been an ice shelf there without it ever breaking up for at least the last 12,000 years. So now suddenly they had this indication that here is an ice shelf that had broken up, and it hadn't broken up for 12,000 years. They also had the kind of information which told them why it broke up. It was the warmest summer on record. There was cooled water on the top because of the heat of the sun. The water kept on replenishing itself, and that water ran down cracks in the ice shelf, and it was the weight of the water that actually smashed that ice shelf. The same with Bill's penguins. He not only had his 30-year data set, but he also had a paleo record where they sort of undid an old nest site, and they sifted through all the little bits of bone and feather and squid beaks and all the things that penguins eat, right down to bedrock, and then they sent all this data back to the States, and they analyzed that, you know, there had been a daily's nesting here for the last 700 years, and no other penguins, just a daily's. So this sort of long-term data set helps them be able to make these statements about climate change. Does that, it's such a big question. I hope that I've given you some examples that make sense.
Absolutely. Meredith Hooper is my guest. Her book is called The Ferocious Summer, A Daily Penguins and the Warming of Antarctica. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak next to Gwenna Kay in Grand Prairie. Hi, Gwenna Kay.
Yes, thank you, Christy. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
My question is, why some group of people, some segment in the society, are still finding it difficult to believe in global warming? What else can be done to convince them that it's real?
Thank you so much for your call. Yeah, Meredith, why do you think people still don't believe in global warming?
This is a tricky question, but I think that it's a very human response, because if you don't believe in it, you don't have to do anything about it. And if you do know it's there, it could be so scary that you don't think you can do anything about it in any case. So it's part of being what I would like to think of as being a responsible human, is to say, yes, it is happening. And yes, we have to acknowledge that we need to do something about it. And that's a sort of middle bit. And that's quite hard. So one of the reasons I wrote, the major reason I wrote the book is I thought, if I can look at one place where without any doubt it's happening, because nobody doubts on the Antarctic Peninsula that warming is happening. It's one of the fastest warming places on Earth. And if I take a population, and there aren't humans there, so that doesn't complicate it. We don't have to feel sort of complex about humans. I'll take the indigenous inhabitants that happen to be penguins. And we say, what happens to them when it warms up? And, you know, they occupy this nice sea view, seashore, the sort of attractive real estate that you know, is liked all over the world, and their food is nearby, and they've been living there very, very happily and successfully for 700 years, and then along comes climate change, and they fail. They can't manage anymore. So I thought, if I told this story, it becomes a kind of parable and for what can happen and what will and is happening on the rest of the world. And maybe it helps people sort of work it out and come to terms with it by living, in a sense, through the penguins.
You talked a minute ago about the idea that for some people who are in denial, it's because the problem seems so big that they don't know what they can do about it. I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the scientists as they witnessed all this, how they were able to sort of stay sanguine as they're witnessing things that really bode very badly for the health of the planet.
I think that scientists are, the little bit of work I've done with them, I respect hugely how austere they are with their standards. They simply will not say anything other than what they're certain about. And this subject is so huge and so politically complex that the ones I was working with were determined to be absolutely rock solid with what they were going to say. I mean, for example, Chris, one of the things that I found difficult as an outsider was that there was the peninsula warming so fast, and what about the rest of Antarctica? And I kept saying to scientists, well, if the peninsula is warming fast, you know, what about, do you connect up what's happening on the peninsula to the rest of Antarctica? And they would say, no, we can't, because we don't understand why it's happening in the peninsula, why this place is warming so fast. So until we understand that, we can't make the connection. And I use this image in the book of sort of seeing the peninsula as Earth's big toe. And I said, you know, the big toe goes first. and it is connected to the foot and the leg and the rest of the body, even if we don't understand how it happens. Well, by the end of 2006, the scientists I was working with had found what they call the mechanisms that contented them. They could find reasons why the peninsula was warming that they felt contented with, and they were to do with upper atmosphere winds and the ozone hole and an increased CO2, etc., in the atmosphere. And therefore, they were saying to me, yes, we can now connect it to the whole of Antarctica, and we can connect it to climate change the world over. But they were so cautious they wouldn't do it until they saw how to do it.
It certainly does nothing to relieve the problem that's taking place right now, but I'm wondering if there have been any efforts to move small numbers of the Adélie population further south, so that they
You couldn't begin to do that. I mean, what's interesting about Adélies is they're independent birds. I mean, one of the things that you know, we all see these beautiful, we're very attracted to penguins, but what we see is the penguin on land. We see it sort of walking along in this, what we think is quite funny, waddling gait. But actually, the penguins spend most of their time in water. They're birds that fly in water, and in water they move with the grace and speed and dexterity. They're quite astonishing. But that's, of course, where we don't see them. And the other thing is that we only see them in summer. And until very recently, people had not a clue where the penguins went in winter. They sort of imagined they went north. But in fact, the penguins at on the peninsula, the Palma, they went south. They very recently found out they went south. And so the whole of the winter is crucial to them. And this has been this great gap in our understanding. We only looked at them when we could see them, and that was when we were there. And now scientists are going south in winter, and they're beginning to try and observe and work out where they go and how they live, because after all, what do they eat? They have to eat in winter just like they eat in summer. And people have sort of got their heads around this amazing, sort of burst of food that happens in Antarctica in the summer, and that's why all the chick raising and breeding happens, and that's why the whales come south. But actually, there has to be food there in winter as well. And whether the food is still going to be there with warming is critical, and we don't know.
So in the minute or so that we have left, Meredith, what do you know about what's happened at Palmer and around it since 2001 and 2002?
Tough. It's tough. The same conditions have continued. The numbers continue to decline, and actually now they are so far down that... in the last 4 years, the number of breeding pairs that Bill has counted have halved. So they're really on the way out. Bill reckons maybe 5 to 8 years, and they've gone. And he says that since his work began in 1975, there's been an 82% actual decrease in Adélies at the 5 study sites he works at, and that's pretty dramatic.
Meredith Hooper's new book is called The Ferocious Summer, Adélie Penguins and the Warming of Antarctica. Meredith, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Well, thank you, Chris. I've enjoyed it very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.